This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio and Skyboat Media present The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World by Douglas Valentine. This book is read by Stefan Rudnicki. Personal violence is for the amateur in dominance. Structural violence is the tool of the professional. The amateur who wants to dominate uses guns. The professional uses social structure. Johann Galtung. Introduction. Chapter 1. How William Colby Gave Me the Keys to the CIA Kingdom. James Tracy. You've been doing historical research for close to 40 years, and I wanted to ask how you orient yourself toward a project. How you know where to look for information that's pertinent to a given story. Valentine. It's complicated, and my experience was different from other writers and researchers I've spoken with about it. From the time I started college back in 1967, I wanted to be a writer. And since then, my philosophy of life has been based on the study of language and literary criticism. I have a very broad approach. I started out studying Greek and Roman literature, reading the Norton anthologies of English and American literature, taking courses in classical myth and the Bible. Very early in my studies, I was introduced to literary criticism, to people like Robert Graves, poet and author of The White Goddess, and Sir James Frazer, who wrote The Golden Bough. Frazer brought a socio-anthropological way of looking at the world of literature. That led me to Carl Jung, Eric Newman, Northrop Frye, and a few other people who approach literature from a variety of different perspectives. Psychological, political, anthropological, sociological, historical, philosophical. All those things were of interest to me. When I look at a subject, I look at it comprehensively from all of those different points of view. Literary criticism teaches the power of symbolic transformation, of processing experience into ideas, into meaning. To be a Madison Avenue ad man, one must understand how to use symbols and myths to sell commodities. Ad men use logos and slogans, and so do political propagandists. Left or right, doesn't matter. The left is as adept at branding as the right. To be a speechwriter or public relations consultant, one must, above all, understand the archetypal power of the myth of the hero. That way you can transform, through words, Joe the plumber or even a mass murderer into a national hero. When I decided to research and write about the CIA's Phoenix program, that was how I went at it. I went directly to William Colby, who'd been director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Colby was the person most associated with Phoenix, the controversial CIA assassination program that resulted in the death of tens of thousands of civilians during the Vietnam War. No one had written a book about it, so I wrote Colby a letter and sent him my first book, The Hotel Tacloban. I told him I wanted to write a book that would demystify the Phoenix program, and he was all for that. Colby liked my approach, to look at it from all these different points of view, so he got behind me and started introducing me to a lot of senior CIA people. And that gave me access from the inside. After that, it was pretty easy. I have good interview skills. I was able to persuade a lot of these CIA people to talk about Phoenix. But I also approached it from an organizational point of view, which is absolutely essential when writing about bureaucracies like the CIA or the DEA. You really have to understand them as a bureaucracy, that they have an historical arc. They begin somewhere. They have a congressional mandate, they have a purpose, and organizational and management structures. And in that regard, I really lucked out. One of the first people I interviewed was the CIA officer Nelson Brigham, who actually organized the Phoenix program. Brigham graduated, magna cum laude, from Yale, and was something of an organizational genius. He explained to me how he organized Phoenix. He also explained the different divisions and branches of the CIA so I'd be able to understand it. So I lucked out. Through Colby, I had access to the people in the CIA who created the Phoenix program, and I was able to find out what was on their minds and why they did what they did. That never would have happened if I had gone to the Columbia School of Journalism, or if I'd been involved with journalism for many years. I'd have had a much narrower way of going at the thing. But the CIA officers I spoke with loved the broad view that I was bringing to the subject. They liked me asking them about their philosophy. It enabled me to understand the subject comprehensively. Tracy, there's an associate of William Colby's whom you discuss and write about, also a CIA officer, Evan Parker. You were able to get a great many names from him, and then you ask these people for interviews. The interview subjects, many of whom were CIA personnel, would go back to Colby or Parker and ask if it was okay to speak to you, correct? Valentine, that's right. Once I had Colby's approbation, many CIA officers thought I was in the CIA. No one had heard of me. I wasn't Morley Safer or Seymour Hersh or someone who'd been a celebrity reporter in Vietnam. I was a nobody in the Eduardo Galeano sense of the word. I'd published a book about my father's experiences in World War II, which some of these guys would read. Those who did read The Hotel Tacloban tended to like it, because it was sympathetic to soldiers and showed I understood what it means to be a soldier. Most CIA officers consider themselves to be soldiers. The CIA is set up as a military organization with a chain of command. Somebody tells you what to do, and you salute and do it. Evan Parker had that feeling about me, that I would understand him personally, why he did the things he did, because I'd written this sympathetic book about my father as a soldier, and because Colby sent me to him. I had an interesting experience with him. He invited me to his house for an interview, and when I arrived, he invited me upstairs to his little den, which was stacked with bookshelves full of Welsh history and poetry books. Parker is a Welsh name. Because of my background in literature, I was able to talk to him about things like the Mabinogion, which is a book about Welsh mythology. I had this broad knowledge that helped me relate to people like him. I put him at ease. Also, for a year before I started interviewing people, I'd read everything I could find about Vietnam and the CIA. I was knowledgeable. Plus, I looked like a good Methodist. I wore a suit and a tie. We spoke for an hour, and Parker got to like me. I hadn't asked him anything about the CIA. We were just getting to know each other. But he had a stack of official-looking documents on his coffee table. He glanced at the documents and politely said he was going down to get us some tea and cookies. "It'll take about 15 minutes. I'll be back." He winked and went downstairs. I opened the top folder. It was a roster of everybody in the Phoenix Directorate from when Parker started it in the summer of 1967. I started furiously writing their names and ranks and the position they held in the program. 15 minutes later, as I'm writing the last name, he yells from downstairs, "Doug, the tea is ready. I'm coming up." I closed the file and put my notebook away. He came up with a tray with tea and cookies on it. He winked and sat down, and I started to ask him about Phoenix. We never got to the documents on his desk, but he liked me, and he referred me to people. That's the way it went with most of the CIA people I met. They cooperated because Colby had sent me to them. Like Parker said, Colby was the director, and we still consider him to be the director. If he says you're okay, we believe it. He didn't say, "Now I can waive my secrecy oath," but that's what they did. I talked to members of almost every branch of the CIA, and I approached my interviews organizationally. What kind of a budget did you have? Who was your boss and how did you report to him? Who worked for you and what jobs did you give them? I had a big organizational chart in my den, and I'd fill in names and positions. I never asked anyone, "Did you kill anybody? Did you do this kind of illegal thing?" And because I approached it in that benign way, they were confident I was demystifying the program and just sticking to the facts. It had the effect of reverse psychology. They trusted me because I didn't ask them their secrets, so they told me their secrets. They didn't like it in the end because I exposed all the secrets. I talked to so many people that eventually they all started thinking that I was CIA. Because the CIA compartmentalizes itself, I ended up knowing more about the program than any individual in the CIA. I got a rat-a-tat going and pitted them against each other. They started telling me secrets about their rivals. They all wanted to be the hero in their myth. Tracy, the interviews you conducted and the multitude of conversations you documented were placed alongside actual documentation, which you had to acquire through a considerable amount of research. Valentine, in the interviews, people were giving me original documents to confirm their assertions. Nelson Brigham was the CIA's head of foreign intelligence field operations in Saigon, 1965 to 1967. Brigham managed the liaison officers the CIA placed in the provinces to work with the South Vietnamese Police Special Branch, which is an organization like our FBI. The CIA created and funded the special police and sent them after the Viet Cong's civilian leadership and anyone else trying to undermine the American puppet government. Phoenix is political warfare. He managed the staff that ran all those operations in the provinces. In late 1966, the CIA station chief in Saigon, John Hart, was working on improving operations against the VC's leadership with a CIA officer in Washington, Robert Comer. Comer was Lyndon Johnson's personal aide on pacification in Vietnam, what was called the Other War. Anyway, Hart gave Brigham the task of creating a general staff for pacification, at which point Brigham went to work for Comer. In creating a general staff for pacification, Brigham cobbled together the Phoenix program. And Brigham gave me, over the course of several interviews, copies of all the original documents he wrote for Comer and Hart. These were the enabling documents of the Phoenix program. That happened a lot. I'd ask a guy if he had any documents to back up what he was saying, and if he did, he'd give me copies of what he kept in his library. Everyone thought, because Colby had sent me, that somehow this was all going to be okay. I wasn't going to reveal all this stuff, or that Colby had decided it was okay to reveal all of it. The documents Brigham gave me showed in his own words what he was thinking when he created the Phoenix program. I posted all those documents online at CryptoComb, along with the taped interviews with Brigham, Colby, Parker, and several other CIA and military officers. They are part of the collection titled The CIA Speaks. I put them online, so my critics can't challenge me on the facts, other than by making up things, which they do all the time. I just quoted from these documents and my interviews. So it's accurate reporting. Tracy, there is a Douglas Valentine collection at the National Security Archives at George Washington University. Valentine, yes, the collection contains my interview notes with close to 100 CIA officers and military officers involved in the Phoenix program. People kept referring me to people, and I made some great connections. I met a guy named Tullius Acampora, who recently passed away. He was in his 90s. He'd been an Army counterintelligence officer and worked for General Douglas MacArthur in Shanghai after World War II. When the CIA was formed, Tully, like many Army counterintelligence officers, started working with the counterintelligence staff of the CIA. He was detailed to the CIA. Although he kept his military rank, Tully was a CIA officer for many years. He went to Italy in 1958 and met and worked closely with Bureau of Narcotics agents in Rome. In the 50s and 60s, federal narcotic agents spent half their time doing favors for the CIA, and in exchange, the CIA gave them intelligence on the mobsters they were going after. Tully was sent to Vietnam in 1966 and was involved in one of the anti-infrastructure programs that Phoenix was based upon. Tully's program was called Cong Tac 4, and like Phoenix, it targeted civilians who were functioning as secret agents for the Viet Cong. When the CIA and military created Phoenix, Evan Parker moved into Tully's office. Tully knew the top Vietnamese officials and CIA officers in Vietnam, and he also knew the Italian-Americans who were prominent in the Bureau of Narcotics and later the DEA. Tully and I became personal friends, and he introduced me to senior people from the Bureau of Narcotics and the DEA. The same way I had entree through Colby into the CIA, I had an entree through Tully into federal drug law enforcement at a high level. I met historically important people and got historically important documents, Most of it new history. I haven't gotten around to digitizing the tapes of the federal drug law enforcement officers I interviewed, but there are separate collections at the National Security Archive for both my CIA Phoenix program materials and my federal drug law enforcement materials. Tracy, I'm wondering how the former governor of Pennsylvania and Bush administration officer Tom Ridge fits into all this. Was he not involved in Operation Phoenix? Valentine, I'm not sure about Ridge. He was in an infantry unit in Vietnam from late 1969 into 1970. He worked in a team with four Americans and seven Vietnamese soldiers going after insurgents, not North Vietnamese regulars. So he was part of the pacification program. He got a Bronze Star for killing a young man carrying a sack of potatoes. He may have been a sniper, and he may have been involved in one of the programs Phoenix coordinated, but it doesn't seem like he was a Phoenix advisor. Ridge had been a governor and had executive management experience when he was appointed to run the Office of Homeland Security and later the Department of Homeland Security, DHS. He was a political cadre who could be trusted to implement Republican Party policy. At the same time, the Department of Homeland Security was based on the Phoenix program model Nelson Brigham developed in Vietnam. Ridge may have had some related pacification experience, which is what Homeland Security is, but he certainly understood how to manage organizations. The key word is coordination. When the National Security Establishment wanted to centralize the war on terror here in the United States through the DHS, they copied how Phoenix had coordinated multiple agencies in order to streamline and bureaucratize the war against the Viet Cong infrastructure, VCI. Phoenix proved an incredibly successful model for pacification in South Vietnam. It was the silver lining in the Vietnam War. Politically, the war was a disaster, but bureaucratically, the Phoenix program succeeded. It became the model for CIA operations in Central America, the Salvador option. The Phoenix program established intelligence operations and coordinating centers in the provinces and districts, PIOCCs and DIOCCs, of South Vietnam. Similarly, the Department of Homeland Security has created fusion centers in every state and major city across the country. The fusion centers coordinate all the agencies in an area exactly like IOCCs did in Vietnam. Systematized and computerized, they coordinate contributing intelligence analysts and operating units. It's the same highly bureaucratized system for dispensing with anything and anyone who can't be assimilated. Tracy, that's an ominous set of observations for someone who has studied the Phoenix program in such great depth. You're saying the Phoenix template is something that has been grafted onto the American homeland. Valentine, absolutely. And I'm not the only one that talks about it. David Kilcullen was a counterinsurgency advisor to the Bush and Obama administrations. And in 2004, he called for a global Phoenix operation. Tom Hayden described Kilcullen as the chief advisor on counterinsurgency operations to General David Petraeus in planning the 2007 U.S. troop surge in Iraq. He also served as chief strategist in the State Department's counterterrorism office in 2005 and 2006, and has been employed in Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, and Southeast Asia. In the section titled A Global Phoenix Program in his 2004 article, Kilcullen describes the Vietnam Phoenix Program as unfairly maligned and highly effective. Dismissing CIA sponsorship and torture allegations as popular mythology, Kilcullen calls Phoenix a misunderstood civilian aid and development program that was supported by pacification operations to disrupt the Viet Cong, whose infrastructure ruled vast swaths of rural South Vietnam. A global Phoenix program, he wrote, would provide a starting point for dismantling the worldwide jihadist infrastructure today. Tracy, how did Kilcullen want to see a Phoenix program imposed upon the world? Valentine, if he understood it correctly, he'd know that the strength of the Phoenix program was in the IOCC centers, which allowed for political control. Through a network of Phoenix centers, management is able to control targeting and messaging. I imagine Kilcullen wanted such highly bureaucratized centers set up in or near nations in which the CIA and military are hunting terrorists. Such centers would allow the White House to direct the CIA, to direct the military, to target the right terrorists. Leave ours alone. Seymour Hersh is always looked to for insight into the CIA. In December 2003, he wrote an article in The New Yorker in which he said the special operations people in the military were going to use Phoenix as a model in Iraq. True to his high-toned style, Hersh focused on the sensational death squad aspect of Phoenix, not the revealing organizational aspect. He keeps the focus narrow. Phoenix is greater than the sum of its parts because it has symbolic meaning. But its lurid aspects, like the death squads Hersh emphasizes, grab everyone's attention. In Iraq, the CIA handed out decks of playing cards featuring pictures of high-value Sunni officials in the Saddam Hussein government. That Psy War gimmick and jargon was right out of the Phoenix program. The purpose of the Phoenix program was to neutralize the civilian members of the underground revolutionary government in South Vietnam. Neutralize was a broad term that included a number of measures. The first step was to identify a suspected subversive. After that, Nelson Brigham, the CIA officer who created Phoenix in 1967, explained the process to me as follows. My motto was to recruit them. If you can't recruit them, defect them. That's Chu Hoy. If you can't defect them, capture them. If you can't capture them, kill them. That was my attitude toward high-level VCI. VCI was the acronym for Viet Cong Infrastructure, the name the CIA gave to the members of the revolutionaries' underground government and guerrilla support system. As part of its congressional mandate, the CIA has the job of counter-subversion outside the United States. Thus, when the U.S. is waging a counterinsurgency in a nation like Iraq or Afghanistan, the CIA pursues a political order of battle, while the U.S. armed forces pursue a military order of battle. In practice, however, counter-subversion during a counterinsurgency is a paramilitary police function. Thus, in South Vietnam, the U.S. military supported the CIA's Phoenix program with troops and equipment. In 1969, the CIA ostensibly turned the Phoenix program over to the U.S. military, at which point soldiers first began to pursue a political order of battle and conduct systematic counter-subversive operations against foreign civilians. The creation of Phoenix was a watershed. Prior to it, military people were only allowed to target civilians if they were secret agents or guerrillas attacking military bases or personnel. But in its fanatical pursuit of victory in Vietnam, the military deliberately blurred the lines between subversives and innocent civilians, and killed anyone who got in the way, including children, like it did at My Lai and a thousand other places. Following its ignoble defeat in Vietnam, America was driven by a reactionary impulse to reassert its global dominance. The justifications used to rationalize Phoenix were institutionalized as policy, as became evident after 9/11 and the initiation of the War on Terror. Since then, the CIA and U.S. military have been conducting joint Phoenix-style operations worldwide without any compunctions, most prominently in Afghanistan and Iraq. Also evolving was the relationship between the CIA, the military, and the media. In Vietnam, there was more press freedom, and the carnage was filmed and shown on TV every night. But the CIA and military felt those images turned the public against the war. So by the time America invaded Iraq in 2003, reporters were embedded in military units. The media became a PR unit of the military and the CIA, with the Orwellian result that the public did not see images of the mangled bodies. The public was denied access to the truth of what its government was actually doing, and when Chelsea Manning leaked the collateral murder video to WikiLeaks, she was summarily tried and imprisoned. When I was doing my interviews for the Phoenix program, certain CIA people would tell me how a particular correspondent from CBS or the New York Times would come into their offices and ask about the programs they managed. The CIA officers would talk openly about their operations, but the Vietnam-era correspondents wouldn't publish the details because their editors had a gentleman's agreement with the CIA not to reveal the secrets. They could know the secrets, and as long as they didn't reveal them, they could continue to have access. While I was researching Phoenix, I went to people like Seymour Hersh and Gloria Emerson, but they wouldn't talk to me. I had a harder time getting reporters to talk to me than I did CIA people, because as soon as they expressed any knowledge about Phoenix, the follow-up question was, why weren't you writing about it? Then they'd have to reveal this gentleman's agreement with the CIA. The Old Boy Network existed in Vietnam, but it's gotten a lot worse. It's impossible now for anyone to interview mid-level CIA people on the record and reveal the facts. Since Iran-Contra, the bureaucracies have instituted incredible obstacles that make it impossible for people to see what's going on inside their private club. The public is totally reliant now on whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, who are then vilified, imprisoned, and/or chased into exile. Tracy, we see what, for example, happened to Gary Webb in the mid-1990s. He had some people who had divulged significant information to him, and yet the CIA denied it, and that more or less cost him his career. He had no one, no colleagues of his who actually went to bat for him to any significant degree to keep him in the industry, because what he was doing is what investigative journalists and historians such as you should be doing. Valentine, yes. Gary Webb was an investigative journalist whose Dark Alliance series in 1996 exposed the link between the CIA's Contras in Central America and a crack cocaine dealer in Los Angeles. The story rattled the CIA. Members of the black community were up in arms. Then the CIA's Old Boy Network sprang into action, and Webb was nitpicked to death by fellow journalists for minor inaccuracies in his work. But his real sin was revealing the CIA's criminal involvement in systematic racial oppression through the war on drugs. Webb committed suicide in 2004. But he wasn't the first American citizen to be attacked for telling the truth about the CIA's central role in drug trafficking. In his 1972 book, The Politics in Heroin in Southeast Asia, Al McCoy detailed much of the CIA's drug network in Vietnam and the Golden Triangle region of Laos, Burma, and Thailand. When the CIA found out what McCoy was doing, one of its most senior executives, Cord Meyer, tried to get McCoy's publisher to suppress the book. When that didn't work, the CIA tapped McCoy's phone, and the IRS audited his income tax. Behind the scenes, the CIA forced McCoy's sources to recant. The famous Church Committee, which exposed a lot of the CIA's secrets, investigated McCoy's allegations and found the CIA innocent of any involvement in drug trafficking. McCoy moved to Australia and didn't return to America for 11 years. The CIA's control of international drug trafficking is America's darkest secret. And after the Webb scandal, the Old Boy Network imposed even more restrictions on the media. The pressures the CIA imposes on the media amount to political warfare directed against the American public. It's no different than how the CIA mounts counter-subversion operations overseas. Nowadays, the only way you can discern what's going on is by studying and understanding the historical arc of these bureaucracies. Where did the CIA come from? Where is it going? If you look at it historically, you can see beyond the spin and it becomes demystified. And that is not a happy story. As power gets more concentrated in the security services, the media is no longer simply compliant. It's functioning as their public relations arm. It simply ignores anything that contradicts the official line. Tracy, there is almost a complete blackout of Jade Helm in the mainstream media. It is only getting coverage and discussion and analysis in the alternative media. Valentine, yes, Jade Helm was a military training exercise in Texas, Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, New Mexico, and Utah. Military and local officials set up Phoenix-style coordination centers as a way of giving special operations and civil affairs personnel experience working with paramilitarized police forces in what was called a realistic war experience in domestic counterinsurgency operations. The media blackout was an essential part of the plan. The censorship was symbolic of how, as a function of the concentration of capital, the communications/media industry, has been centralized and is now part of the political warfare apparatus. The media industry has been reduced to a few huge corporations that control most of the outlets. Control of information has become the key to the oligarchy's success. Very few independent news organizations are able to compete with the giants or get information out across the country, so people really have to search for facts on the internet. Tracy, even some of the alternative progressive left media that were good 20 or so years ago are increasingly dependent upon foundation money that comes with strings attached, and they're not as inclined to push the envelope as I think they once were. Valentine, sure. As a person who is interested in how the CIA uses language and mythology to control political and social movements, I see this development as ominous. People like Glenn Greenwald, who take money from billionaires, insist it has no editorial influence on them. But media people who are taking money from billionaires and CIA-connected foundations must realize that their sugar daddies can sink their operations in a moment because of something they write. And that knowledge surely impacts what they are willing to do and say. Taking money from a billionaire also has tremendous symbolic meaning. It means the person taking the money approves of one person having $8 billion when 3 billion people barely survive. Through their example, celebrity media figures like Greenwald are telling their followers that they support the exploitation and imperialism their benefactors engage in. As all advertising people know, symbolic messages don't have to be articulated. They're understood subliminally. Greenwald's followers like it that way. It means they don't have to consciously confront their tacit support for an unjust system. That self-censorship allows celebrity journalists like Greenwald and his sidekick Jeremy Scahill to promote themselves as heroic adversaries of the system. And they'll continue to get away with the double game until their followers start challenging their own basic assumptions. The system will never change until people climb out of their comfortable darkness and start rejecting the system's inequalities instead of just feeding off of them. Tracy, you mentioned Greenwald. There are other prominent figures on the left who fashion themselves as freedom fighters in the informational sphere, where that's arguably not the case. This is something that I think goes back over 40 years to Daniel Ellsberg. The most important case in the freedom of the press in the 20th century, if not the country's history, was the Pentagon Papers. And yet Ellsberg himself was a member of the CIA. Valentine. Well, Greenwald and Ellsberg certainly aren't left, and Ellsberg was not a fully integrated, backstopped employee of the CIA. But for a period of time in 1965 and 1966, he did work for the CIA's station chief in Saigon, John Hart, whom I mentioned earlier as having initiated the Phoenix program, gathering intelligence on what prominent South Vietnamese politicians and officials were thinking. I was told that Ellsberg could recall conversations verbatim, and that he was introduced to these important political people at social events, and then reported to Hart about their thoughts. He was also working at a high level in the pacification programs upon which Phoenix was based. Ellsberg worked with CIA officers Edward Lansdale and Lucien Conin, and U.S. Information Service officer Frank Scotton, about whom more remains to be said. The problem is that Ellsberg presented himself in his autobiography as having been working with the State Department. That was his cover. And in the movie about him, he's pictured in an army uniform on patrol. He misrepresented himself. He wasn't honest. All of his work with the CIA is absent. Why? It goes back to the fact that Ellsberg was a full-fledged hawk who turned against the Vietnam War. But after he leaked the Pentagon Papers, the left adopted him as a symbol of someone who saw the light. The left takes credit for ending the war, and Ellsberg is a central character in its narrative. So the anti-war movement in particular, and the left, whatever that is, in general, goes along with the cover story. But people can't understand the significance of the Pentagon Papers, or the true nature of the Vietnam War, without understanding Ellsberg's work for the CIA. His worldview was defined by his intimate relationships with his mentor, Ed Lansdale, and the other political warfare people he worked with in Vietnam, especially Frank Scotton. Ellsberg, Scotton, and a handful of other experts prepared America's organizational blueprint for pacifying South Vietnam's civilian population in the seminal Roles and Missions Report in August 1966. That study sets the stage for the Phoenix Program. All this loops back to the issue of access. I didn't know who Scotton was until Colby referred me to him in 1986. Like the other people Colby referred me to, Scotton thought I was CIA approved. He tried to impress me, and when I interviewed him at his home in McLean, Virginia, he said, "We," which could only have meant him and Colby, had instructed Ellsberg to release the Pentagon Papers. Scotton has since written an autobiography in which he denies having told Ellsberg to do it. He now says Ellsberg merely showed him the Pentagon Paper documents in 1970. All this also loops back to CIA drug trafficking. A moment ago, I mentioned that Al McCoy's sources had recanted. Chief among McCoy's sources who recanted was Dan Ellsberg's former comrade, Lou Conneen. When McCoy spoke to him in the summer of 1971, Conneen confessed to having arranged a truce between the CIA and Corsican drug traffickers in 1965, at the same time he was working with Ellsberg. The summer of 1971 was a busy time as well. Colby was due to testify to Congress about the Phoenix Program in July, but a larger event grabbed the headlines. On June 13, 1971, the New York Times began printing lengthy excerpts from the Pentagon Papers, that painstakingly edited stack of documents that, even by name, deflected attention away from the CIA. Consequently, little public attention was paid when, on July 15, 1971, the Times reported, "Previously classified information read into the record of a House Government Operations Subcommittee today disclosed that 26,843 non-military Viet Cong insurgents and sympathizers were neutralized in 14 months through Operation Phoenix." All these threads weave together to create the myths Americans believe about the CIA, and Ellsberg's cover story is part of the fictionalized tale. Tracy, the reluctance of certain editors to publish what you've researched and revealed about Ellsberg, do you think in part that has to do with just a wish to sustain the legend of Ellsberg, the symbol of what he's become? Valentine, sure. They're part of the same network of management-level media people the CIA influences, what CIA officer Cord Meyer dubbed the compatible left. Let me tell you about my experience with the compatible left. William Morrow and Company published the Phoenix Program in 1990, but before it hit the bookstands, the New York Times gave it a terrible review. After that, the media wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. As far as the left was concerned, the book presented new material they couldn't digest. I guess it threatened their proprietary claim on Vietnam War history. The militant right was never going to acknowledge it anyway, but the left's leadership is part of the CIA's old boy network. And like all American intellectuals, they look to the Times for direction and validation. So the word went out to ignore the book, not just because it revealed CIA secrets, but because it identified the media, and the Times in particular, as the reason why the public can't see the CIA clearly for what it is, a criminal conspiracy on behalf of wealthy capitalists. I had also noted that the release of the Pentagon Papers distracted attention from congressional hearings into Phoenix. In subsequent books, I added that it distracted attention from reports on CIA drug trafficking as well. In any event, all my access to the CIA was meaningless. The CIA, through its friends in the media, was able to neutralize me. Only a handful of people recognized the book's historical value, people like Al McCoy, who called the book the definitive account in a blurb for the iUniverse edition. But my supporters all had the same response. I'd crossed the line and would never get another book published in the United States. So I learned the hard way that the CIA has a strategic intelligence network of management-level people in the information industry who know, through instruments like the Times Book Review section, what books and authors to marginalize. Peter Dale Scott had also been marginalized as a result of his 1972 book, The War Conspiracy, and his 1993 book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. Peter supported me, and a few years after the Phoenix book was published, I mentioned to him that I was writing an article based on my interviews with Scotton and Conneen about Ellsberg's deep political association with the CIA. Peter is Ellsberg's friend, and even though the article had the potential to embarrass Ellsberg, he arranged for me to interview him. Peter gave me Ellsberg's number, and I called at a prearranged time. And the first thing Ellsberg said to me was, "You can't possibly understand me because you're not a celebrity." If you want to understand the critical role celebrities play in determining what society accepts as real and valuable, read Guy Debord's books, The Society of the Spectacle and its sequel, Comments. Debord explains the symbolic role celebrities play, at times inadvertently, in maintaining the illusions we confuse with reality. Debord cites the German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, who famously said, "But certainly for the present age, which prefers the sign to the thing signified, the copy to the original, representation to reality, the appearance to the essence, illusion only is sacred, truth profane. Nay, sacredness is held to be enhanced in proportion as truth decreases and illusion increases, so that the highest degree of illusion comes to be the highest degree of sacredness." When Ellsberg told me he was a celebrity, he was saying that he underwent a symbolic transformation the moment he leaked the Pentagon Papers and landed in a social realm that alienated him from non-celebrities like me. He became an icon. And nobody on the left is about to say, "Oh my God, Valentine had this revelation about Ellsberg. Let's rethink everything we believe is true." Like its doppelgangers on the right, the management class on the left is invested in celebrity heroes who represent their business interests. They focus on the symbol and ignore any contradictory but essential facts, the way Greenwald and Scahill ignore Pierre Omidyar's funding of the Center for the United Action in Kiev, which was a Phoenix-style coordination center for covert political action. If the owners of a symbol are forced to talk about an embarrassing fact that undermines their business interests, they interpret the fact narrowly. This is one of the methodologies the political parties and their compatible media outlets employ. They summarize and misrepresent a problematic subject in 9 seconds and then repeat the summary over and over again. They don't take the approach of a literary critic. They don't look honestly at what the government's carefully chosen words mean. They don't look for what's not said. In fact, they play the same game. Their methods are identical. I experienced the same thing when I wrote my article about Ellsberg. No one on the American left would publish it. Eventually, Robin Ramsey published it in Lobster magazine in Great Britain. The article was called "The Clash of the Icons," and demonstrated that Ellsberg and Al McCoy held contradictory positions about the CIA's relationship with drug traffickers in Vietnam. McCoy accused CIA officers Ed Lansdale and Lou Conneen of collaborating with Corsican drug smugglers in 1965. At the same time, Ellsberg was working closely with them. But when I interviewed him, Ellsberg insisted that these CIA officers were not involved in the drug traffic, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Several years later, Alex Cockburn and Jeff St. Clair published my Ellsberg article in Counterpunch. They were having fun ridiculing wacky left assumptions and sacred cows, like Israel. They loved my Phoenix Program book and my article on Ellsberg, which they renamed "Will the Real Daniel Ellsberg Please Stand Up?" They featured it in Counterpunch, and of course everyone on the left ignored it. Maintaining Ellsberg's image is mostly a business decision, because Ellsberg is what the mafia calls a moneymaker. If one of these compatible left media outlets has Ellsberg talk at a peace conference it's sponsoring, 100 fans will pay cash to see him. The compatible left is a business venture that's dependent on the capitalist society within which it operates. At the same time, Ellsberg is a symbol of the illusion that change is possible within the system. He calls for reform, yes, and like the compatible left, he backs many important progressive programs. But more importantly, by covering up his own CIA connections, He's reassuring the bourgeoisie that subscribes to these media outlets that everything they assume about their leaders is right. And that's how symbolic heroes mislead the way. This is Ellsberg's symbolic function. As a certified hero who has achieved celebrity status, he proves the system works. He leaked the Pentagon Papers and stopped the war. And he suffered for it. President Nixon wanted to put him on trial for treason. Nixon's staff pulled all sorts of dirty tricks to intimidate and discredit him, but he soldiered on. That's the myth of the hero. But there are no heroes, and the system doesn't work for everyone, like it rewards Amy Goodman at Democracy Now, or like it rewards Greenwald and Scahill. If Ellsberg were to reveal the CIA's secrets, he would no longer have the same reassuring effect on the liberal bourgeoisie. So his sponsors never mentioned that he had an affair with the mistress of a Corsican drug smuggler in Saigon. That's not in the book or the movie. He denies his CIA buddies were involved in the drug trade, even though they were. He won't talk about the CIA war crimes he witnessed or the contradictions of capitalism. Like Seymour Hersh and other liberal media icons, he avoids naming CIA officers or detailing the CIA's class functions. He's an expert who tells the bourgeoisie it's all under control. He serves this symbolic function, and he's been doing it for 40 years. And if, like me, you violate his sanctity by revealing the truth, you'll never get published by the compatible left. You lose access. Tracy, a recent incarnation of Daniel Ellsberg might be Jeremy Scahill. You mentioned Democracy Now! A moment ago. He was a correspondent for them in the early 2000s, when the Iraq War was ramping up along with the War on Terror. Valentine, Ellsberg was never a reporter or a media mogul like Scahill, but they are both celebrities. Ellsberg with the older generation, Scahill with naive millennials. They are also similar in that Scahill made a grandiose documentary film about himself in which he characterized himself as a hero. He barely mentioned the CIA in the film, and his publication, The Intercept, avoids any analysis of the CIA as an instrument of capitalism and imperialism. Scahill and Greenwald have the same pacifying effect on the liberal bourgeoisie as Ellsberg. They rile them up a bit with recycled exposés, but symbolically, they're part of the system. They style themselves as alternative, but they're not about to engage in self-criticism or risk revealing the critical evidence that would indict individual CIA officers. It's a catch-22. Until the media stops covering for the CIA, people will never understand how illegal covert operations systematically distort our basic assumptions about everything. Meanwhile, these media celebrities perpetuate all the myths upon which the class system is based. Greenwald and Scahill are too busy grabbing for the candy and portraying themselves as heroes and winners who made it big. Tracy, the war on drugs, as you chronicle in your books, fundamentally changes in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Can you provide us an overview of the CIA's increased involvement up to the present? Valentine, the Bureau of Narcotics was removed from Treasury and recreated as the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs in the Justice Department in 1968 because it had gathered indisputable evidence that the CIA was running the Golden Triangle narcotics business. The heroin being sold to American soldiers in Vietnam was coming from the CIA's clients in Laos. Al McCoy wrote about this back in 1972. The CIA was protecting the major opium producers in the Golden Triangle, just like they've been protecting the major drug dealers in Afghanistan for the last 15 years. They were funneling heroin and opium to their warlords in South Vietnam as a payoff for advancing the U.S. policies that were detrimental to their own country. The CIA bought their services by allowing them to deal narcotics, and a lot of the dope made its way back to the homeland through enterprising soldiers and various criminal organizations. It was a criminal conspiracy of the highest order. The National Security Establishment realized the conspiracy was on the verge of being exposed in 1968, so it pulled various executive management, enforcement, and intelligence functions out of the BNDD and gave them to the CIA so the CIA could protect its drug smuggling assets around the world. At that point, federal drug law enforcement became an adjunct of national security. Tracy, so this firewall that theoretically exists between the CIA operations abroad and in the United States has been bypassed in the war on drugs. Valentine, yes. And by studying the relationship between the CIA and federal drug law enforcement, you can see why I refer to the CIA as the organized crime branch of the U.S. government. Nowhere is that more evident than in how it controls international drug networks. If you're a general in Bolivia and you're assassinating leftists, the CIA will allow you to deal drugs. If you're Manuel Noriega and you're providing intelligence on revolutionaries in Central America, you're allowed to deal drugs. If you're a South Vietnamese general or an Afghan warlord, you're allowed to deal drugs because you're furthering the national security interests of the United States, which means it's corporate as well as political and social interests. In order for this to happen, two things are important. The CIA has to control certain branches of the DEA, and it has to control the media. And it has systematized its control over these institutions. Chapter 2. One thing leads to another, my rare access in investigating the war on drugs. Ryan Dawson, let's discuss the relationship between crime and law enforcement. You talked about this in an article about an experience you had growing up in New York. Let's start off with what you learned in your young adulthood, and do tell about the relationship between crime and law enforcement, if there can even be a line. Valentine, what I learned is that there isn't a line. The story I'm going to tell about my experience is allegorical. It's a microcosm of the way the world works, how propaganda and Madison Avenue advertising convince people that there are forces of good fighting forces of evil. But if people saw through the propaganda, they'd have different attitudes, and our country would be structured differently. But the lawmaking branch of our government is in the hands of professional criminals. Everything they do is in the service of crime, of holding down or stealing from the poor, and protecting or giving to the rich. I came to realize all this as a young person, thanks to my father. The lesson my father taught me occurred in 1968, just 23 years after World War II. It's almost 50 years since then, so the experience I had was contextually closer to the good war than the bad Vietnam War. Adult men in 1968 viewed America as having saved the world for democracy. It was easier to be rebellious back then, when millions of middle-class white males had to re-educate themselves and support one another in order to avoid being killed for Dow Chemical and Dow Jones in Vietnam. My father worked in the post office in the village where he'd lived as a child. He worked the graveyard shift, and I worked for a tree company in town. I was home from college for the summer, and I worked for the Cogshaw Tree Company, climbing trees. My father and I didn't get along, but I ate breakfast in the same diner where my father had a cup of coffee after getting off the graveyard shift. These were the days of the generation gap. He sat on one side of the diner by the kitchen door, with the cops and the older blue-collar workers. They'd talk about how much they hated Muhammad Ali, who had refused to go to Vietnam, and Joe Willie Namath. My friends and I had long hair and resisted the war. We were smoking dope and taking acid, and our girlfriends were young and pretty and sexually liberated, thanks to the pill, so they hated us too. One day my father and I met at the cash register. He was waiting for me when I got outside. "I want you to meet me tomorrow at the bank," he said. "There's something I want to show you. Come about an hour early." We didn't get along, but he was my father, so I did what he said. The bank was at the other end of Wheeler Avenue, but not far from the diner. My great-uncle Tom Colligan worked there as a security guard. Tom had been a cop in town for many years. My father's father had been a cop in town, too, during Prohibition. Anyway, we met at the bank the next morning and walked down Wheeler Avenue toward the diner. The sun was just coming up and nobody was on the street. We got to the corner store at the end of Wheeler Avenue and turned right up Manville Road. The diner was a few steps up the street, and I could see the bread delivery truck parked in front of it. Another car was parked beside it. I knew who the car belonged to. My father walked into the street with me following behind. He stood behind the delivery truck, flung the back doors open, and said to me, "Take a good look. This is the true relationship between crime and law enforcement." Inside was the bakery truck driver, the mafia representative who picked up the money and slips from the local bookie. The bookie worked at the diner and was sitting beside the bread truck driver. In the back of the truck were three village cops. I'd known them all my life. I went to school with their kids. I knew their names. They'd been caught red-handed and their mouths were hanging open. When they started muttering curses, my father abruptly closed the doors. He walked away and went about his business. Me too. The next day, I was back in the diner, and nobody said a word. It was like I'd been initiated into a secret society. Most of the people in town had no idea this was going on. They thought the cops give you a speeding ticket. They don't see the cops associating with professional criminals and making money in the process. They believe that when a guy puts on a uniform, a guy who was a bully in school and didn't develop the skills to be a plumber or go to college, he becomes virtuous. But the guys who go into law enforcement relate more to the crooks they associate with on a daily basis than the citizens they're supposed to protect and serve. They're corrupted. The CIA is populated with the same kind of people. Nelson Brigham, whom I mentioned in the previous chapter as the CIA officer who created the Phoenix program, told me this about his colleagues. "I have described the intelligence service as a socially acceptable way of expressing criminal tendencies. A guy who has strong criminal tendencies but is too much of a coward to be one would wind up in a place like the CIA if he had the education." Brigham described CIA officers as mercenaries who found a socially acceptable way of doing these things, and I might add, getting very well paid for it. Occasionally the cops have to arrest criminals and put them in jail, but it's generally the ones who aren't in the mafia or mafia guys who broke some agreement. If you're black or a minority, you're rarely going to benefit from this accommodation the cops have with organized crime. What I witnessed was mind-boggling, and being 18 years old, I wasn't ready to think about it then. But I did think about it over the ensuing 20 years. And as I started researching and writing, that experience and some similar ones I had got me interested in the underworld. Things like the mafia's involvement in the Kennedy assassination. I wanted to learn about those things. In 1981, my father gave me the lesson that got me writing. We hadn't spoken in 10 years, but he'd just gotten out of the hospital after his second open-heart surgery and his defenses were down. He called me up and said, "I understand you want to be a writer. Come on home. I've got a story to tell you." Turns out he'd been a prisoner of war in World War II. He hadn't told anyone, but he'd been a POW in the Philippines in a camp with around 120 Australian and 40 English soldiers. My father was the only American and aligned with the Aussies. The camp commandant, a major in the British Army, made a deal with the Japanese. In exchange for having control over discipline in the camp, he would ensure that there would be no escape attempts. The Australians didn't care what this English major said, and four of them tried to escape. But the major found out and informed on them. The four Australians were brought back to camp and beheaded on Christmas Day 1943. A couple of days later, two Australians, along with my father, murdered this English major in retaliation. Nothing happened until the camp was liberated in October 1944, at which point the existence of the camp was covered up. The military gave my father a new military record and warned him that if he ever told anyone about the camp, he'd be prosecuted for his role in the murder of the English major. I wrote about that in my first book, The Hotel Tacloban. I'd seen the true relationship between crime and law enforcement, and after my father told me his story about the prison camp, I knew the military can rewrite history. It can coerce someone into silence so deep and damaging it causes heart disease. That was a turning point for me. I realized how deeply entrenched the corruption is, and I began to observe the forms it takes in our society, including racism. The double standard associated with racism allows one group to get away with breaking laws and unfairly punishes another group for breaking the same laws. That's corruption. It's organized crime. Meanwhile, the CIA, the military, and the cops are covering their collective asses through their propaganda outlets. They're corrupting our understanding of the world by controlling the information we receive. They create the myths we believe. If we were allowed to understand the CIA, we'd realize it's a criminal organization that is corrupting governments and societies around the world. It's murdering civilians who haven't done anything wrong. The military does the same thing in a more violent way. Cops, too. The Vietnam War had greatly affected my generation, and I wanted to find what sort of secret things the CIA did in Vietnam. As a first step, I spoke to the director of a veterans organization in New Hampshire, where I was living at the time. I asked if there was any facet of the war that hadn't been written about. Without hesitation, he said the Phoenix program. So I decided to write about Phoenix. I sent a copy of Tacloban to William Colby, who'd been director of the CIA and was closely associated with Phoenix. Colby read Tacloban and liked it. His reaction was, "Well, you have a basis to understand what happened in Vietnam." We did two interviews, and he introduced me to some senior CIA people who were involved in facets of the Phoenix program. It was incredibly eye-opening for me. I wrote about all that in the Phoenix program. In the course of investigating the CIA in Vietnam, I learned that huge amounts of narcotic drugs were flowing from the Golden Triangle area in Burma, Thailand, and Laos. The network began after World War II, when the CIA had set up a Kuomintang army in Burma. The Kuomintang was the ruling party of the nationalist Chinese, who'd been chased out of China by the communists in 1947. The CIA watched while the nationalist Chinese massacred about 30,000 people in Taiwan in 1947. The Kuomintang had fantasies of reconquering China, and the CIA played on those fantasies. It established a Kuomintang army in Burma and used it to attack China. At the same time, the CIA was conspiring with the Thai government, which was up to its eyeballs in drug trafficking. Opium trafficking wasn't frowned upon in that part of the world the way it is here, and the press here took little notice. By the 1960s, the CIA also had a secret army in Laos under Vang Pao, the leader of the Hmong tribe, who supported themselves by growing opium with considerable CIA assistance. The Hmong were looked down upon by the ruling ethnic Laotians, who ran a CIA-protected heroin processing operation. The CIA worked with the Hmong and Laotians just like the cops and the mafia ran that bookie operation in suburban New York. Opium from the Kuomintang army in Burma was moved by mule caravan to Wo Sai, Laos, next to the CIA's 118A base at Nam U. And from Wo Sai, it was flown to Taiwanese middlemen who worked with the mafia. Opium from the Hmong was converted into heroin in Vientiane. The CIA controlled the operation and made sure that some of the heroin and opium got to Saigon. Top generals in Vietnam controlled various provinces and regions like warlords. The CIA made sure